Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+, and also on Periscope, at TotalTutor. And I'm always excited about my guests, but again, this is the Just Two Choices celebrity segment, so I first want to welcome the program my co-host, Rico Rakoski. Rico, how are you, man, and how are things?
Great to catch up with you, Neil, and I hope all is well with you. It's high vibes as usual.
Exactly, and I know you're excited about our guest, for sure, and especially we've not had a lot of NBA players on this Just Two Choices celebrity segment, so go ahead and introduce him.
Oh, absolutely, and it's really exciting. It's an honor and privilege to have with us today the All-American forward for probably the greatest basketball team to ever play for the University of Oklahoma, and then on to 13 years in the NBA, predominantly with the Washington Bullets and Washington Wizards, and a little bit with the Trailblazers and the 76ers. And, you know, he's known for his great outside shooting skills as well as for being the NBA's having the lowest turnover rate in NBA history. And it doesn't stop there. Folks, he has three sons now playing pro basketball in Europe and for the Knicks and for the 76ers, the exceptional Harvey Grant. Harvey, what a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you for being here.
Got to say, thank you all for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Definitely, Rico, and isn't that interesting? You should have written the bio for him that I put on the website. You're awesome, and that was such a great introduction, Rico. So go ahead.
Well, you know, one of the things, Harvey, that comes to my mind initially for most people in any kind of a position, though, that sticks out in my mind, like, that's, you know, have you always found that even in your younger years, even playing in high school basketball and college basketball, that you were a perfect fit for the forward or for the power forward position in basketball? Or did it evolve from something else? Maybe you're playing baseball. I don't know. You know, maybe as things went on, different coaches had different strategies for you. But as you know, as you moved through basketball in high school and on into playing for that great team for the University of Oklahoma, had any of that shifted or changed for you over the years? Or were you always in that forward position?
In my high school and college days and a lot of period of my NBA career, I was in the forward, but I also played some center. Mm-hmm. I also played a little two guard out in Portland. So I kind of moved around because I knew if I wanted to stay on the court, I had to play different mm-hmm. positions and do mm-hmm. different things.
Mm-hmm. And so it's something like that. You're finding that, like, moving into the center position depended upon matchups and different coaching decisions as well.
Yes. You know, I can remember one time I was playing for the Bullets, and when I came back to the Bullets, and we had Chris Webber and Juwan Howard and George Marison, and I think George was hurt, and Chris was hurt, so I had to play the center. I had to guard a guy like a mm-hmm. Patrick Ewing, and that made for a long night.
Yeah. So Harvey, when your height, we're talking about height, and, you know, playing power forward and different things like that, and as we know in high school, they put you in different positions and stuff. With your twin brother at those times specifically enough. Tell us, you know, how dominant were you guys in high school playing together? How wild was that?
We had a pretty good team, and during the high school period, my brother Horace, he was basically like the power forward, and we had another guy. He was about 6'6". And, you know, a nice stocky guy, and he played center, and I played small forward. So we did okay in high school. But I don't know if you guys remember a guy named played at Kentucky, Kenny Scott Walker.
I remember him.
He's also from Georgia. Yeah, he's also from Georgia, and we played them in the championship, and we just couldn't get by those guys.
Oh, yeah. Skywalker was a player, and especially in college. Oh, my gosh. And so that's interesting. You talk about you guys couldn't win at all with two NBA players. I wonder how many high schools Harvey ever had two NBA players on the same team. Not many, I don't think.
Not many. I can't name any right off the top of my head, but I'm sure it's not that many.
Yeah. Yeah, well, then shifting gears, you know, with that excitement that you had, you know, I can't even imagine what it's like being matched up. I mean, even with your own brother playing basketball. I mean, my brothers and I are all real close, and it's so much fun when we play sports. So I can't even imagine what it's like to be playing ball together. You know, you did in Clemson as well, and then you went on to Oklahoma. Could you tell us about the excitement that went on for that NCAA championship? Because you guys weren't even on the radar. You know, just to slide into the Final Four, and you guys pulled it off. Could you share with kind of what went on behind the scenes? It sounded like with the coach there, that all of a sudden the switch got flipped. What was the chemistry? Can you recall some of that?
Yes, we had a coach by the name of Billy Tubbs, and he was, you know, he was a great. I'm telling you, you know, he was a great coach, but he was more of a great person. And, you know, he just told us, you know, he threw the ball out there and said, you know what, guys, you know, everybody, they put their pants on just like you put your pants on. And he just go out and play. And I tell you what, in 1988, that was a wonderful, wonderful ride. And we played some great teams in the NCAA. And I think at the end, we ran up to a team, Kansas team. You know, I would never forget this, you know. against a team, I guess it was the basketball gods and Destiny.
Yes.
On their side. They had a guy in Danny Manning.
Oh, yes.
I tell you what, he had the game of his life. I think he had like 38 points,
yes,
15 rebounds, and 8 assists or something like that. You know, they end up beating us by like 5 or so.
Oh, I remember that. So I wouldn't have thought that. Okay, thinking about Oklahoma, Billy Tubbs, I remember all that. I'm a huge college basketball fan, by the way. And so, Harvey, so thinking about that, playing and seeing how Kansas just went on fire, you guys probably beat them by like 30 points in the Big 8 during the regular season, didn't you?
Yeah, we had beaten them 2 or 3 times that year. Matter of fact, we had beaten them 2 or 3 times that year, and you know, we didn't go into, you know, the championship game overconfident, but you know, we was we knew we had a chance to, you know, to win. But I tell you what, man, with Danny, you know what he did would, you know, would go down in history.
Oh, most definitely. And but to think about it, it was not just the Danny Manning story. It was the Larry Brown story as well. You know, so you had a variety of things going against you in that. But playing in that environment, playing in the Final Four, there's nothing like it, I guess, to the NBA Finals. Harvey, to deal with how much hoopla, how crazy it was, and to be in that environment, that stage, it must have been amazing, wasn't it?
Oh, it was unbelievable, guys. It was unbelievable. We, you know, it was a one time in a lifetime, you know, that you get to the Final Four or even get to a championship game. You know, some guys who play college ball for, you know, 4 or 5 years, you know, they never get that far. And some, some now, you know, they get there maybe, you know, twice a year. But I tell you, back in 1988, you know, we knew we had a chance, you know, to get there if everybody did that job. And everybody on that team, you know, did their job. You know, we had a guy, a point guard, Ricky Grace. He was, you know, dish out the assists. We had another guard in Mookie Blaylock.
Oh, yeah.
Who played 13 years in the NBA. And he would play both ends. You know, he would play good offense, good defense. And we had another guy, Stacey King, who got drafted by the Chicago Bulls a few years back. I had myself, and we had another guy named Dave Seager. But what people didn't know that we had five guys off the bench that could start for any other team in the country.
Yes.
So that made us a real, real good team.
And looking at your background, Harvey, you have the lowest turnover rate in NBA history, the sixth lowest turnover rate in NBA history, which is quite a statement for your situational awareness, that all the way around. And so it seemed like that team from 1988, it seemed like one of the strategies there was to force turnovers. You did a lot of full court pressure kind of things. Was that part of what your style that evolved, or were you somebody who was really good at minimizing turnovers and forcing turnovers on the other side? Is that part of the strategy that you guys built into things? Because I know you had kind of a run and gun style back in '88.
Right. I think it was a combination of both. Our thing was to press you. From the time you get off the bus until the time you get back on the bus.
Yes.
So we pressed the whole game, and we can be up, we can be up 30, and we are still pressing. We're still pressing the ball. We're all over the court, and then when the starting five go out, then the other five come in, and they just pick up where we left off at. And I can remember a game out in I think in the Maui tournament. I think we played Virginia. I'm not sure. I think it's Virginia or Georgia, one of them. And Virginia scored 100 points, but they lost by 29. So right. That means we had to score 129 points.
Yes.
So,
It was a definite run and gun, and it was a different style of play, Harvey, especially in that time in college basketball. You really kind of tired teams out. You were moving and grooving. I remember Oklahoma completely. But isn't it funny, Harvey? I think of you specifically enough as the twin with Horace, the NBA. Never thought of you those days in college with Oklahoma. So the question I have to ask you is, what was your average? How big a star were you at Oklahoma? You had Mookie Blaylock. You had Stacey King. So you were pretty much the third of the big three for Oklahoma, you'd say, at that time?
We was right there together because at that time I was a senior and they was a junior. Mookie and Stacey was a junior. So, after I left, and then, after I left Oklahoma and went into the NBA, they kept going. And really kind of made a name for themselves also, but I thought we was kind of right there together.
Okay, so but you did things just like you did in the NBA that was quiet, meaning you just did your business. You went about your business. It was nothing flash or showy about it. We all know Mookie had some flash and show to him in his game. But you were pretty much a workman-type attitude, right, in basketball. Rebound, fundamentals.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I guess you had one of the lowest turnover rates in the NBA, right?
Yes, no question at all. From my high school days and college days and throughout my NBA career, myself and my brother, the only thing we want to do is win. We never really want to show anyone up, or if you make a dunk, it's a dunk. You go back on the other end and play defense. You don't scream and yell. We didn't do that. That wasn't a part of our game. And I think, I think that's why we didn't, we wasn't known as a flashy players or something like that. You see guys now, if they dunk a ball, they want to yell and, do this and that. And we wasn't, that wasn't us.
Interesting.
Tied to some of those basics too, that you're talking about, Harvey, there's something that we don't see on a regular basis for those of us who aren't on the court like you spectacular athletes are. What are some of the choices that you have to make outside of the game, with regard to your workout schedules. I mean, you have your regular games, but what do you do? What are your practices like? Even in the pros, what are your practices like? And how do you do you push yourself in your off time away from a game, or is it mostly during the off season? Then you're cruising and staying in shape during the season. How is it that you work your practices and your workouts to keep yourself tuned up for the for the endurance of
NBA
the whole season?
When I played, we used to practice for about 2.5 to 3 hours, a day.
Right.
And now I think, with the new CBA collective bargain agreement, you practice maybe an hour and a half. But back when I played and my brother played, we practiced for 3 hours.
Oh, my.
You know, and I'm talking about we practiced for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And sometimes even that wasn't enough if you wanted to, stay in the NBA for, a decade or more. You had to work after practice. You had to come to practice. You had to come before practice and get some work in. And I can remember I played with a guy, a Hall of Famer in Bernard King.
Yeah.
And when I tell you when he works in practice and it carried over to the game, and I learned so much from guarding him in practice, every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helped helped me stay in NBA for a long period of time.
That kind of a work ethic, that you have there, which brings up. I know Neil was. I think Neil would be going this direction with your son. So I'll just kind of introduce it this way. That brings up mentorship. I take it Bernard looked up to Bernard and to some degree he was a mentor to you.
Development league. And what I learned, I learned from guys like Bernard King and Darryl Walker and Jeff Malone. Those guys were truly a professional. And like I said, we practiced like 3 hours a day. So, in order to get better, you have to guard a guy like a Bernard King, or
right.
You may have to guard a guy like a Darryl Walker.
Yes.
to get better.
Bernard is just now tell me about mentorship with Bernard. We saw the special, that came out, I think it was an ESPN 30 for 30 special on Bernard King, came out a couple years, I think it was a year ago, and how much of a battler and hard worker he was, and how he constantly reinvented himself. What did you learn from him?
To be honest, I learned what it takes on and off the court to be a professional. I learned that from Bernard, and he was, when I say in practice, he taught in practice, it was just like being in a real game. He didn't shortcut anything. And if he saw you, kind of shortcutting, he would come up and say, "Hey, we gonna need you. You can't shortcut it." So from day one, I learned what it took to be a professional on and off the court. And he was one of the hardest workers that I ever had a chance to play with. And if you know about Bernard, he blew his knees out and with the broke fingers and scoring 50 50 back to back, and I think against Houston and San Antonio, back in the late 70s, that right there showed me that if you have a broken finger, stomping your toenail up, you can still get out there and play. If you want it bad enough.
Definitely. It's so true. You want to keep playing, and again, Rico, you look at his career. How many years he played? You got to play with injuries, Rico, and all that, right, Rico? Yeah.
In addition to that, and just like just like you were talking about before, Harvey, being able to be you know, to move around to different positions like you talked about, you know, switching over to center position or based on matchups and coaching decisions. So, you know, it's all these things that you have to work with mentally and physically. And thanks for giving us those insights into the practices and stuff, because I've always kind of wondered how much practice really went on, especially with the challenging pace of the season that you have too.
Oh yeah. You know, like I said, back when I played, we went 3 hours. When I say we went three hours. It was 2 hours and 20 minutes. It was 3 hours. And now I think, you know, with the new agreement, you know, they can't go no longer than hour and 45, I think, or maybe 2 hours.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to jump to the sun thing, Rico, and then I know you have more questions. More I'm going to talk about training. How much did you push your kids to play basketball? Because, you know, Harvey, we hear about these stories. Look at the Mannings. You look at particularly, you look at Peyton Manning and how Archie and the different families, Colquitt's, the punter for the Steelers, had two punters that ended in the NFL. The ones that ended up professionally from a dad in this lineage and stuff. How much did you push them? Or was it just basically they just had the ability and you mentored them? Was it something like, I want my kids to go ahead and do this?
No, to be honest, they didn't push them that one bit. But, you know, they wanted to go to games with me, you know, to spend some time, you know, because being an athlete, professional athlete, you're on the road all the time. So I would take them to practice with me. They would play, you know, one-on-one with some of my teammates before practice, after practice. They would be ball boys, and they just grew up around it, and they just started to love it, you know. But I never pushed them, but once I found out they had the love for the game, then I started to teach them, you know, what it's going to take, you know, to get to high school or get to college or one day get to the NBA. So, you know, once I found out they really wanted it, then I started to teach them a little bit.
Interesting.
And have you found it with the sons that they come back to you and they're asking you advice? Are there any questions that pop out in your mind in terms of some of the questions your son have asked you about, you know, like college ball or necessarily about, you know, maybe offers that are made to go to the NBA, you know, like the Knicks or, you know, like with Jirai playing over in European, you know, basketball. Is there anything like that that is memorable? They've come up to you and they've asked you and you kind of said, oh, that's a good question or hadn't thought about that or anything like that?
No, once they were in college and, you know, they went to a school here in Maryland, you know, DeMatha Catholic High School, is a very prestigious high school, one of the best high schools in the country. They had good guys over there to kind of teach them a little bit. But once they got to college, you know, they were like, Dad, you know, what do I need to do? And I, you know, for me, I say, you know, you have to get stronger and you have to buy into the system that your coach is teaching. And you have to work harder than the next guy.
Right.
And I think, you know, once they got that, you know, once they got those things down, and I knew that no one was going to outwork them. You know, they may some other kids may have the, you know, more talent, but you're not going to outwork them. And I can remember a lot of morning guys. They used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go and work out and then go to school. So right then I knew how much they wanted it.
Phil, I got a quick question tied to that. It seemed to imply with the way you were saying buy into the system. Are there some players sometimes that resist that particular coaching system? Is that what you meant by that in terms of buy into the system?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, you know, you have a lot of guys, you know, they come from, you know, from a high school AAU program, and they want to, you know, they've been shooting the ball all the time, and, you know, they want to be a star. But you may go to a Notre Dame or Clemson or Syracuse, and you got to buy into that system. If you don't buy into that system, you know, either you're not going to play or you're not going to be there. And that's, you know, and a lot of guys, you know, don't want to do that. That's why you see a lot of guys, you know, transfer going to another school.
Interesting.
So that must be a challenge. Yeah, that must be a challenge then whenever you switch in pros too, you know, buying into the system, even if you go to another pro team. So thanks. Go ahead, Neil. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're getting close to running out of time, but Harvey answered all these great questions involving Oklahoma. And how does it feel also with your brother Horace and how he achieved more, not numbers wise, you guys are close numbers in the NBA in years, but what about rings? Is that ever eat at you?
All the time. You know what? And he never let me forget it. he never let me forget it.
A true brother.
You know. I played for a long time, and I just, you know, wasn't fortunate enough to get a ring. But you know, I played with some great players, and I was, you know, blessed to be in the NBA. You know, it's an honor and a privilege to play in the NBA. And I tell my brother Horace all the time,
90 seconds.
Three or four rings. If I had played with Michael and Scottie, Shaq and Dan and Kobe and Shaq, you know, I'd have had maybe two or three.
And you probably, did you?
Sharpen your tools, right?
And Harvey, you probably went and was kind of bragging when you were in the Final Four. You probably are saying, maybe I shouldn't have done that to Horace after all those championships.
Yeah, I got all American, and you didn't.
60 seconds.
Exactly.
And Harvey, do your kids say we want to win championships like our uncle, not like our dad? And say,
they mess with me some, you know, sometime when they go out to LA and visit my brother. You know, they go out there every summer and spend some time out there, and they put his rings on and send me pictures and stuff. I'm like, oh, when would this end?
that's what's interesting, but I think it's always going to be the part of the legacy of the Grants to look at specifically that. But we'll see how your kids achieve in the NBA, and if we're going to see, especially where they're going to be going professionally in all three players. But okay, now Rico, the way we finish the show, Harvey, is we have a survey that Rico conducts, and it's a very interesting survey. So Rico, go ahead and let us know what the survey is.
Okay. Thanks, Neil. Now, Harvey, we asked just a simple question. It's a percentage question. And, you know, there's different ways of looking at life. And the way the philosophy of just two choices is that in every moment, there are just two choices. You're either going to be at practice and you're going to be out full throttle, or you're going to be something less than full throttle, like you were talking about with Bernard, for example, you know. And so at every moment, there are just two choices. And so when you look back at life, what percentage of life do you think for you has been created because of choice, and what percentage is maybe circumstance? And some people said 80-20, 90-10. We have all different kinds of answers, so there's no right answer. How do you feel in your heart with regard to that? What percentage of life is choice, and what percentage is circumstance?
I think with me personally, I would say 85-90%.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, in life, we have, you know, we all have choices, and we come from different circumstances. But, you know, we was raised in a small town, and we didn't have that much. But we knew right from wrong, you know, we knew right from wrong. And, you know, we could have went the other way, but we had a choice not to, and we chose not to.
Yeah. God bless you. Bless you. Thank you again.
And Harvey, best place we can find information on you. It's kind of funny when I message guys on Facebook, because you never know if they're promoting anything. I just, again, when I saw, wow, Harvey Grant's a friend of mine on Facebook, or like I'm connected with some celebrity on LinkedIn, I said, I got to have him on the show. But Harvey, is there anything you're promoting?
Yeah, I have a premium water company I started about a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And you can go to g4beverages.com. It's a premium water company, natural alkaline water. You know, I named it after, you know, my four boys. So, you know, go and check it out. And you know, if you love alkaline water, that's the water to drink. And the name of the water is Clear Water.
All right. And any places to find you.
Thank you. All the best to you and your family and your boys.
Absolutely. And Harvey, anything else? Like, is you have the website? Do you have anything? You're on Facebook personally. Do you have LinkedIn or anything else that you want people to kind of connect with you? Or is the best place to go to your website and email you? What do you think's the best for you?
Just go to my website and you can email me.
All right. Well, good talking to you. Best of luck. Thanks again for coming on the show, Harvey. It was a fun time. And take care, guys. Thanks again for being on the show.
Okay, right. Thanks, guys. Thanks
all right, take care. Okay, again, thanks. Again, that was the Just Two Choices celebrity segment. Take care, guys. And we'll be live again tomorrow. A bunch of interesting Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I'm so excited about my guest today, and it's always the second time I've had her on the program. She's a award-winning musician, much more. We're going to talk more about family lineage and some of the other stuff she's doing, so I'm excited to welcome to the program Consuelo Vanderbilt Costin. Consuelo, thanks for calling, and how are you?
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very, very good. I tell you, last time we talked, your music was just booming in Europe. Give us an update before we go into some of the topics tonight. How are things going there?
Things have been amazing, actually. I just launched my album in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland at the end of August, and so I was on a press tour there, and new singles coming out November 7th, and so it's just been an amazing year of really launching this album, and then it's coming into the U.S. and worldwide beginning of January.
Oh, wow. So we'll have to have you back on the program to talk about the launch in the U.S. It's amazing to look at, you know, specifically we are such a global society that, you know, to have fans all over the world, it must be amazing, isn't it? It really is for you to have that ability that they love your music all over the world and to go on these press tours. Oh, yeah, I'm just going to travel to Germany and do the whole thing. And it's a lot of fun, isn't it?
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, you know, I feel really blessed that, you know, Germany has been such a big market for me, and just they love music. They love to have fun, they love to dance, and they really love to have a good time. So I just, honestly, I just love going there, and it's really exciting, and I just feel blessed to be able to do this with my life. So I think when you can never follow your dream, what a gift is that.
Oh, absolutely. You got to follow your dreams, and that's the key component in everything is following the dream, and you never know where you're going to land from there. And you have so many. Exactly. So let's break down a little bit more of your family lineage. It's so interesting to go back into looking at specifically enough the bloodlines for sure. We discussed it a little bit, but I mean, how much is that is that very important for you to really continually looking at, you know, your ancestry? I think it's so important, especially you see Ancestry.com and all these different TV shows and all these things. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Well, you know, moving back to New York 3 years ago, I swear to God, I feel like I'm on this incredible history lesson right now. And what I'm so inspired by, you know, Cornelius started out with $100 and he asked his mom and he became the richest man in America. And I really think it is kind of building the American dream. And so when I'm here and I'm able to go through, you know, Grand Central and just the impact and the power of what my family has really built, that's inspiring to me. And it just makes me want to work harder and, you know, grow stronger and embrace my legacy in a very just unique and I don't know. I just, it's one of those things, you know, it's almost too big, you know, that I feel like I'm constantly learning more and more, and that's so exciting. So I think, you know, moving back to New York has been probably one of the best things I've ever done.
Well, and moving back to New York, then you more and more learn what's going on and to kind of really let people know. So before being in New York, where were you living, Consuela?
I was living in L.A. Uh-huh. Before that, I was in London. I was signed to Sanctuary Records there and then moved to L.A. And, you know, I loved L.A. It was a great experience, but it's totally different than being in New York. I think that New York is a much more fast-paced lifestyle. And L.A. is a little bit more lax, and you're in your car a lot more. And it's a very different experience, but I'm so happy being here.
And so the heritage, let's go back to, like you talked about before, coming from nothing to becoming very, very wealthy and successful. I think that's something that we need to speak in our country so much that that's what we have in the United States, the opportunity to be anything we want to be. And I think that's another excitement about talking about your family is that, you know what, they came from nothing, right?
That's right. Yeah. No, Cornelius, you know, as I said, you know, asked his mom for $100 and really he became, you know, as I said, the richest man in America. And what I love is that his son then grew the business even further. And Consuela Vanderbilt, my great, great aunt, the Duchess of Marlborough, I mean, she was a huge pioneer for the suffragettes and, you know, and these amazing women and powerful women and role models. And that's what I aspire to be. So again, I think, you know, moving here and not really, you know, my mom was born here and I was born here. My mom spent a lot more time here than I did. I feel like as an adult, being able to see this with new eyes and appreciate it in a totally different way is just a very powerful experience. And I love it.
It's powerful. When you look back at Cornelius's life, what types mm-hmm. of what do you take from that and say this is how I have to live my life in this way and I have to be able to model specific things? We all look at, you know, at certain role models and certain people, but looking at Cornelius's life and how he became successful, what do you take from that into your everyday life and work and family life and everything like that?
I think that's a great, great question. No one's ever asked me that. I think probably the greatest thing that I'm learning about him is what a visionary he was, mm-hmm. that he really saw a necessity in the marketplace, and he kept looking. He would see one thing, and if that wasn't working, then he would try something else, and nothing stopped him. So I feel like he was fearless. I've also heard some very negative things about him, including when I was in a history lesson when I was 17, and I was like, okay. But I would say that, his fearlessness and being bold and brave, those are the things I take from him.
And Consuela, I think that's what it's important is, because you got to be bold in being a recording artist, especially trying to finally get your huge break in the U.S., but you see that the whole world's there. A lot of people could just give up and say, you know what, I don't feel like becoming a star everywhere else in the world, and the United States is not, you know, appreciating my music to this point. You're being bold, saying I'm going to continue to do this and have success, and at one point I'll break out in the U.S. And when that time comes, but I'm going to continue to show that I'm not going to give up for anything, right? And I think that's where you take a lot of Cornelius's life and stuff. Yeah.
Well, and like my last four singles in the U.S. were top 20, and the last one actually went to number 5. Single called Body Needs. So I feel like, you know, I'm really trying to work as many artists, you know, different areas and kind of grow my music as much as possible. I think that, you know, we are in a day and age, which is so extraordinary, is that people can discover you that you never knew, you know, would have ever found you. And I love that because, you know, we never, that wasn't accessible before. But, you know, it is, it's a ruthless business, and there's so many, you know, knockdowns, and it's being that kind of resilient and fighter within yourself to keep saying, you know what, I believe in this, and I love music so much that it will always be a part of me.
Right, and what I'm saying,
the album called Just Me, yeah.
And you're definitely having success in the U.S., but yet not getting to the level that you can't that you are in other countries. Like if you walk down the street in other countries, you're pretty much a rock star in Germany, right? Meaning everyone knows who you are, right? Am I correct, Consuelo, in that way?
I don't. I mean, honestly, I don't know about that. I would say, just to be totally transparent, that's very sweet of you to say.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's totally 100% true. I think that I've made an impact there, and again, the fact that I keep getting asked back and I'm doing more and more things and it keeps growing, that's what I feel. So I don't know if it's I'm walking down the street and everyone
knows. So where would you say your bigger star, in Europe or in the United States? The Europe, right? Correct?
I would, yes,
yeah,
definitely.
So
yeah.
How can we make it so that we got to start tweeting out now? How can we make Consuelo as big a star in Europe as in the U.S.? That's a question I have to ask you. Honestly, I'm being
bold. You're going to do it.
Okay.
Neil, this is your job. So this is Neil's job. Everyone who's listening, I want you to know that Neil is just, he's decided that he's going to do this right now. You're going to make me the biggest star in the U.S. right now today. That's the goal.
I've loved it. How we could definitely do that. But no, but what I'm asking, I'm just wondering in this way, and then we're going to get back into this, but I'm being bold in this, these questions, asking you these questions, but
yes,
really,
Laura,
I mean,
I love it.
But think about that. You know, you think about specifically how big you are in Europe. You just gave me these numbers and I'm mm-hmm. like, but I haven't in a way. And it's again, because of the genre of your music, right? That in Europe,
yeah,
it's you could have these great rankings in the U.S. But to get to that point of, you know, a Lady Gaga or Katy Perry or something like that. What do you need to do next? And I got to be, it's just basically, right place, right time, right song that kind of just takes off. How does that work? I mean, you've seen it and just how it's taken off in Europe, but I'm just wondering, yeah.
This is the thing. I think it's just about continuing to build stories and shows and people hearing. And, you know, I own my own label and all four of my songs have been on my own label. So it's very different doing distribution and territory deals with other countries. And then being able to bring that back around. And I think that what is different from anything else that I've done is that this album is really multifaceted. It's pop rock. It's, you know, the album's called Just Me. It's really, it's a piece of me in every song. And there's a lot of differentiate in the sense like there's, you know, live drums, there's program drums. It's
90 seconds.
You know, I've traveled the world and written this record with some of the greatest musicians and producers. And so I hope that when it really enters the market here that people like it, and you know, I'm really proud of it. And so
do you feel it's your most successful album yet? Do you think it's the most successful album to date? The one that's now taken off
in Europe. About to come out?
Yeah.
I am going to say that this is my baby, so I hope
60
I hope it
seconds.
Does.
Well, I hope so too. So continuing the conversation.
And you know.
Yeah, and we're going to continue live, even though we're still live for a couple more minutes. Somehow, you know how these systems work. But let's continue the conversation. Now, when you talk about specifically enough the family and Cornelius, and you said that there's bad things that they've said about Cornelius. You really like his bold attitude, and he did not take no for an answer, and he kept going, as I see from you for sure. And I'm going to help you in that whole journey of becoming a rock star in the U.S. just like you are in Europe. When we think
that's right.
You've already called me to that.
I'm going to call you every single day now. And you're going to play my songs every day.
you didn't know that this was going to happen.
10 seconds.
No, I never know what these conversations I have. It's so much fun, and who I talk to people. I make best friends with people, and I never get to meet them. I guess we're close, at least, from New York to Pittsburgh. It's not like I have to jet set all the way over to L.A. I'm probably a six-hour drive to New York. But let's kind of go right into, like,
so,
exactly. So we talked about specifically what I'm wondering is, do you think that his image can change Cornelius in a way through, you know, your constant, you know, bringing up your relationship and meaning in the family, and to kind of search back in ancestry? Have you done that yet, Consuelo, to see if some of the things that are in the history books are incorrect about him, about Cornelius?
You know, there's a big thread about him. So I, you know, it's one of those things. I haven't met him. I wish I could have met him. So I would never, you know, I wouldn't be able to say. But from a lot that I've read and learned about him, it seems pretty consistent. But again, until you meet someone, I don't think you can really judge.
No,
I'm sure that at that day and at that time and what everything he was trying to do and be unstoppable the way that he was, I'm sure he had to make decisions that way, you know?
Exactly. And then that doesn't end this family heritage, does it, of very interesting people in your family. When are you going to write this book about this?
All.
When are you going to write a book about all this? About your family.
It's happening.
It's happening.
We're in the works.
Okay. I knew.
Listen, we have Homage coming out, you know, on HSN December 21st, and that is the five generations of the Vanderbilt women and the inspiration collection. And so I am bringing back the Vanderbilt name into modern day, into my own interpretation of it.
And I guess so. That's December 21st. So that's gonna be really exciting
December
for you.
December 21st.
Yeah. So that I guess you're gonna.
Yep.
I'm gonna have to reach out to your publicist and say we have to get you on to promote that the day before, 2 days before, for sure. You're awesome.
Oh,
I think you're gonna.
I love you, Neil. This is what's happening. I'm gonna be on every single day.
Oh, you knew my schedule. I'm as busy as you, and you're royalty in so many ways, just based on the family. So I want to learn a little bit more of the family, and we'll talk more about the HSN thing. So going through each one, going to your great aunt, who's was the Duchess,
yes,
of Marlborough. Explain that,
yep,
to me in specific ways so that people understand that person. And we'll kind of go to the different people all the way up to your mother now. So that's what I find very fascinating as a historian and everything. So go ahead.
So, sorry, what were you asking?
Yeah, so tell about the Duchess of Marlborough and the kind of her background. Your great great aunt.
Well, you know, yeah, she married, you know, the Duke of Marlborough, and just the things that she did to empower women and really fight against the grain, and the way that, you know, her mother was very strict, and I think she had a really hard life. And again, she really fought for her own beliefs and women's beliefs. And she was absolutely remarkable and so beautiful and so statuesque. And, you know, she created something called the Children's Jewel Fund. And so what she did was she actually asked all of her friends, all of her society friends, to donate a piece of their, like, greatest jewelry possession. And then she donated that to a brilliant organization. And she's just, you know, that's what I love about, you know, really learning more and more about my family is the way that they gave back and took care of people. And I think that that's so important. And I really, you know, want to always do that myself.
Well, definitely, I think that you are doing that for sure. And you're keeping this very interesting. Now, going to your great-great-grandfather, William Kissam, Vanderbilt II, tell me a bit about him.
Well, you know, and what I love, actually, I was just there shooting yesterday at the Vanderbilt Museum, which is his house, which is my great-grandmother, Consuela Vanderbilt Earls. That was her summer house. And it's just the most remarkable place in Suffolk County. And they've actually kept the museum exactly intact as it once was.
Wow.
And so his cars and just, oh, it's just an absolutely magical place. So, yeah, you have to go there. If you haven't been, to anyone that hasn't been.
Where's the museum located?
Please go.
Where's the museum located?
It's in Suffolk. It's in Suffolk County in Long Island.
Long Island. Oh, we're gonna have to take a trip out there at one point in time. When I'm going back to New York for the National Publicity Summit, I have to make it a weekend thing and more than just the summit. I don't know if you've heard of that Steve Harrison's deal. I go and represent the member of the media out in New York. So I got to make this a big New York trip.
Fantastic.
So I'll have to. I will
come and meet you there. And honestly, we will have the best time. And you'll love the people and the members of the museum. Like, they're so passionate and they know so much about the family. And my grandmother was on the board. And it's a really special and incredible place. It's a planetarium. There's a mummy in there. There's crazy animals in there. I mean, it's just insane. All on the most beautiful property.
Oh, wow. That'd be very fascinating.
Yep.
And then also your great-grandmother, Consuela Vanderbilt Earle, that goes back again to this museum, correct? This house, correct? Is it kind of passed down?
That was her summer house. And, you know, she was a great love of terriers and this beautiful, dainty woman that I only met four times at the plaza. The most intimidating woman ever, I can never tell you. But she was remarkable and so beautiful. And that's actually the reason for homage, because 2 days before my wedding, I inherited this beautiful pearl and diamond turn-of-the-century ring, which Consuelo, who I was named after, actually died on my birthday at 107. Can you believe that?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yes, that's good for you. I was about to say my grandmother passed away about a month ago, and she was 102, so... We'll see if.
Yes.
So you're hoping.
But Neil, this means we have a long life together because I'll be calling every day.
Oh, jeez. You're funny. You're so funny. Oh, my gosh. funny, but okay.
Never ending.
You never have any people interview you. They always interview you in your music, and you're like, so fascinating. I want to know about your family so much. But that interests me. Wait till I tell my wife. She's so into history as well. And so I'm going to make it a date where I'm out to the summit, the National Publicity Summit. I'm promoting this thing. If I'm there, that's why everyone should go and sign up in April, I think. But we'll definitely play that by ear.
We'll make a plan. We'll do a whole thing, and then we can promote it on your show, and we'll have people come there and have a day trip to the museum.
Oh, I love that.
How great would that be?
So we'll definitely have to set that up. Okay. Going to Iris now, your grandmother. Did you know your grandmother well?
Yes.
Iris, yes? Tell me.
I did. What a great, again, such a beautiful, intimidating woman. So strong. And she decided at the age of 50 that she was living in Locust Valley, and she had this great passion for llamas. Now, let me tell you, have you ever experienced llamas? Have you ever been anywhere near them?
No, I have not. Llamas? No, I mean, I have not. No.
All right. They want to be left alone. Like, you don't need to go near a llama. You know what I mean? They really just want to sit and graze and be by themselves. And, like, they really, no, they're not really the most friendly of creatures. So this is classic. I was living in London at the time, and my grandmother asked me to fly over because she was shooting these calendars. And I was 12 years old, and no joke, I don't know if she thought llamas were horses in some sort of way, but she set up. So, like, January, I'm walking with one of the llamas. You know, February, I'm trotting with one of them. Now, dude, they're huge creatures. They are not interested in trotting. And then, in, like, March, she would try to set up, like, these little, horsey jumps. Well, they're not moving anywhere. So at one point, one of the llamas had me pinned down, and it's, like, kicking and spitting at me. And she's like, what did you do to the llama? And I said, what did I do?
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. It was classic. She was a brilliant, eccentric, wonderful woman, and I was absolutely terrified of these llamas. But then she ended up owning one of the biggest llama farms in Oregon. So, complete character.
Oh, wow. So she was living, she wasn't living in Long Island then, your grandmother? No.
She was. She was living between Locust Valley and Oregon, yeah.
Okay, back and forth. Nice trip to Oregon.
Yep.
Gotcha. especially when the cold weather comes to Pittsburgh. I mean, if it's New York, like, and it's got to get out of there for sure. Now, your mother, Serena.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about what you were able to pick up from her. And then I guess we'll get in. That's how I guess the whole collection comes about is specifically about all the women. Yes.
My mom was about the most special, incredible human being I've ever met. She just was a zest of life. She made everything okay. And when she walked into a room, she was so funny. She had the dirtiest sense of humor. And yet, in this incredibly, you know, waspy background, and yet she was just so hysterical. And she could say things and get away with murder with these incredible devils. And she was just a magical person. And I wish that the whole world could have met my mom. And she died, actually, 6 years ago from ovarian cancer.
Oh.
Yeah, at 55.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, so it could have been so much more long. Oh.
Way, way too young.
Yes.
Way, way, way too young.
And that pretty much puts you in
not to be Debbie Downer or anything.
Exactly. But then, that pretty much puts you a big responsibility early, Consuelo, about the family and making sure that the entire estate and all these different things with your mom passing. I mean, that's tough on you.
Yeah, and that I would honor her.
Exactly.
That's the most important thing for me, is that if I can go to sleep at night knowing that I have done something really good for my mom in the way that she would be proud, then I'm okay. That's always that's my barometer. And so, she made, this is the craziest thing, and again, not to go on too much about this, but she made dying okay, which I know that sounds insane, but she never had any pity. She only was always filled with life, and when she was in pain, she never talked about it. It was extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it. And so I was with her for 4 years, taking care of her, probably the best thing I've ever done. It changed my whole life.
Well, it just seems like you're on a tremendous journey. That's what it sounds like
to
me.
Thank you.
It sounds like. And when I just interviewed for music, I didn't really, we talked a bit about the family, but it looks like, I guess after I interviewed you the first time, you just said, Neil wants to interview me again. I know Neil very well. That's the way I kind of connect. And when I have more time, I can really connect more. That's why I love doing this, is because just the ability to just really get to know and make connections with people all over the world of a variety of backgrounds and different things. And you're doing some tremendous things for sure. And again, HSN, December 21st, go in a little bit more into this, to the collection. And I think what's so fascinating is, again, is that bringing all the Vanderbilt women involved in this process, so that, you know, now you can look at specifically what makes it so fascinating, what you're going to be presenting. You said is a book in development as well, because everyone wants to know this family history, don't they? Especially with, you know, you talked about the house and everything, but just the whole story, right?
Yeah, you know, and that's really this whole journey, you know, is about bringing the Vanderbilt name into the modern day, and what an incredible family it was, and what an amazing legacy it was, and that I think it needs, you know, a breath of fresh air, and for people that don't know and the people that do know, really it's kind of our American royalty, and I'm so proud of that. And so each piece of the 24 collection, you know, 18 of them are inspired by different members of the five generation of the women of my family, and then my own modern take. And so I talk about each piece, and there's old pictures of them actually wearing the pieces.
Oh, wow.
And then it's just, yeah, it's really exciting. It's kind of bringing the world back to life in a certain way. And I love that. And to me, it's all about just, you know, storytelling, which is what you love to do. You love to hear stories, and, you know, so.
Yeah, I definitely love
to
hear stories.
That's why we'll be talking every day.
Well, you have my number now, so you'll be texting me and all this stuff, and I'll be like, okay, sure. You know, it's just it just happens that way that people are interested. It's like, New York, I think if you're in New York, it'd be interesting if you probably know all these different people from the Real Housewives of New York and California and L.A. and all those things. You just, again, you've kept yourself to a different thing. But your life story is very interesting as well. I mean, the music, come on now. And then I didn't even know this. I mean, it's funny, the publicist that I connected with to get you back on the show. And I was like, she's so amazing. And all this stuff, as I got to interview someone else before, she's like, oh, you'd like to interview Consuela? I haven't. And she told me all about, she said, I've interviewed her before, but it's just like when I get to interview someone a second time, it's like, hey, you know, we're just having coffee. It's not like, oh, what is she going to say? I had a feeling and you remind me, but you just finished filming something as well. You have so many different projects, right? So you're not just a singer, but you're an actress.